Gertrude Stein lay dying on her deathbed, which was a good choice. She had started out on her sickbed, but then thought, well, you know, change is good. Well, she lay there dying, and she looked up at her companion, Alice B. Toklas, and she said, Alice, what is the answer? What is the answer? And Alice says, what was the question? So that version I actually got from a Shelley Berman album, The Comedian. Now, I'm not sure that's exactly how it went down. My understanding is that Gertrude asked the question and Alice just sort of stared at her because what are you going to say? And then later thought, yeah, now what was the question? What is the answer? What are the questions? Those are both difficult questions, aren't they? I can't answer them. But I am going to try to answer some questions today merely as a way of demonstrating that questions are more important than answers, that answers are always sort of made up and an attempt to speak to the subject that the question poses. But they're not always easy, especially if the question is not specific. Now, if you were to ask me, what time is it? I could answer that probably. What is time? Forget it. We're going to have a very long conversation. At the end of it, we're going to probably make a phone call to a physicist. So really what I'm going to do is I'm going to answer some questions, or try to, or speak about them, or repeat the question a lot, rhythmically, for entertainment purposes. I got these questions from you, my friends. I said, do you have any questions for me? And I anticipated that some of them would be serious. Say, what's your favorite kind of ketchup? Some of them would be silly, like, you know, how many... I can't even think of anything silly, because I'm such a serious person. Some of them would be attempts at being clever, which is something I might do or pun or something like that. And then some of them are fairly wonderful. They're all wonderful because all questions are wonderful because you can steer them. As you know, if you've heard a politician pretend to answer a question, questions are really the point of departure for either what you were already going to say or thinking out loud. Now, mine's going to be basically thinking out loud because I don't want to deceive you. Answers can be so dangerous. If you ask me a question and I answer it sincerely and with some kind of look in my eye that convinces you that I know what I'm talking about, so many of us doubt our own abilities and our own intellect, and we are susceptible to those who we believe are confident and capable and more intelligent than we are. And so we might see that answer as a definitive answer and change our life. Now, I would never do that to you. I would either give you some answers to choose from or repeatedly tell you I don't know and invite you to my answer search. What my answer search is basically is you ask me something and I go to my mind palace, the rundown mansion that I visualize in my head, and I start rummaging around and looking for things that might pertain to what you've said. So if you ask me what my favorite food is, I might go into my mind palace kitchen and start rummaging around in there and say, oh, I forgot I even liked fried wonton noodles that come. Remember they used to, you'd go to a Chinese restaurant and they'd have a whole bowl. Even if you didn't order soup, they would go like, go ahead, knock yourself out. These are cheap. And you'd say, thank you so much. I now feel sick, so I won't be getting an entree. Thank you for coming. May I have my cookie, though? Yes. Cookie, open up. Fortune says you're going to make yourself sick on the appetizer or the chips. And they're right every time. But I always have, did you save room for dessert, they'll ask you. Well, where is it? Room where? Exactly. I have room in my fridge. I'll take it home there. I don't know about my stomach. Someone offered me a piece of pie the other day. I was at their house and they said, would you like a piece of cherry pie? I was like, yeah, cherry pie is my favorite. I said, I'd love it. And I thought they meant to take home with me. But they're like, put it on a plate and give me a spoon or fork and say, here. I don't want it right now. I thought they meant take some with me. So I had to sit there and eat a piece of cherry pie that I wasn't really into. I wasn't hungry because I didn't want to point out that there had been a misunderstanding. I was embarrassed. That's so funny because that embarrasses me. But if my pants fell off, I'd be like, I'm just a human being. I don't know. I have different rules for myself than I have for others. So that's dumb. I'm going to now begin these reading these questions. And this is very exciting. Some of you say, oh, I bet I'm going to find out all about Hardy. Oh, no, you won't. Well, you might. It's always interesting when somebody else sees something in you that you don't see. I guess that's entirely possible. All of you have a better understanding of the back of my head than I do. You've spent more time with it. And if we've been on a long car trip, you may have studied it. Like the moon. Say, look at that. At first you look at a human head and it looks smooth, but I'm looking at Hardy's head and it looks like it's been hit by meteors or something. And perhaps it has. It is. It's taken a lot of blows off of a lot of what you're seeing are the inside of a car trunk, because I come up on it, especially the locking mechanism. I've never knocked myself cold, though. I had a friend that did that. He bumped his head and he knocked himself out. I've never gone that far. I always have to exaggerate because it never leaves, I think, an adequate mark. In the cartoons, you'll get a really proper lump. It'll come up, look like an anthill or a mesa. And I'll say, that's what I need. Because they'll say, that shows you. Look how I told you it was a bad bump. But a lot of times, it's just a little. I'll say, look, can you see my head? And they'll go, there's a tiny red mark. And I go, no, it can't be. It can't be. I've trepanated myself. There must be a hole in my skull. It can't just be a little mark. So sometimes we have to, and we do this a lot of times, is exaggerate the pain. We're not really exaggerating. We're just trying to get the effect of the pain, the reality of it, the truth of it across to someone. Say, look, it doesn't look like I'm in pain, but let me, maybe I'll moan. Oh, see, I told you I'm hurting. Emotional hurt is hard. It's really hard to convey when you're hurting in a way that's not physical, too, isn't it? And that's why I try to acknowledge that on the show, because you go around and think, am I crazy? I'm hurting and no one seems to care. Oh, we are such blind creatures. I'm so sorry. I understand. If we used something other than our eyes, we're so fixed on those senses that sometimes we ignore other things. So let me now begin with the very first question, and this is from John. John asks, he actually demands, this is not a question, please elaborate on the function of compassion versus justice and the limitations of perception in achieving both. Now I know John, so he's being he's actually being serious. He's being serious and fun in the same, isn't that beautiful, in the same way. He's like, look at this serious questions, you know, but if you really look at it, it's an important thing that he's been thinking about and I've been thinking about, you know, like justice and compassion. You got to define them first, and that takes a lot. I don't even know what justice is always. When you're wronged or someone is wronged, it's very difficult to determine what to do, because a lot of times you can't get the person or the thing back, right? So, you know, what does it mean, justice? Can it restore something that was taken? Can we restore our hell, our emotions, our souls at least? It's a very complicated question. And what is compassion? How do I know that I'm doing something that's best for somebody, or I'm loving them, or I'm showing them mercy? It could be just the opposite. That's why you can't stop thinking and questioning. You eventually have to make decisions, and you're always going to make decisions on not enough information. There's never enough information. So, but you know you've done your due diligence if you're always thinking, and you always have your eyes open, and you're always looking for things. You're always looking for joy, and you're always looking for people's pain, and you're always looking for secrets. You're always looking at mysteries, and you never stop wondering. That's keeping all your eyes open. So, I've talked only about the limitations of perception in achieving both. It's hard to figure out what a situation even is it? You know, look at the courts of law. We have famous cases. You know, how can we decide what's right and wrong and who should be held accountable? It's very difficult, and we get it wrong a lot, a lot, a lot. And I'm telling you, though, the alternative to thinking, as the Bible tells us, and it really does, it's not a bad thing. But in the book of Samuel, the people get tired of their judges because their judges and the law it's complicated, and judges are human beings, so they mess up and they're corrupt, and all this figuring out and deliberating. So the people say, we want a king like everybody else. So it's just cut and dried, black and white. King says it, it's what I believe. That way I don't have to think and I don't have to work for anything. And just want that king. Just get me that king. And I guess that's what I object to is ceding the authority of your mind to someone else, because you cannot stay in a state of confusion. But you can, I'm telling you. Come live here with me in a myriad of possibilities, in a land of lots of truths, in a land of conflicting truths. I want you to join me in a world where there is a perspective for every living thing. Every creature that walks is seeing the world in a slightly different way. Isn't that amazing? So you can join in on some of those ways through art and through using your mind. Oh, your imagination. Come with me. I'm not going to try to talk you in too much into using your imagination because I don't want any competition. If everyone used their imagination, I'd be out of luck, because that's what I deal in, the imaginary, and you'd be able to make your own imaginary. What would I do then? What would I do then? What if everybody could draw their own comic books? Boy, it'd be a lot of miserable people who are already miserable who draw comic books. Be like, now I'm more miserable than I was. The second question Paul asks, do you prefer lace-up or slip-on shoes? When I was a very young child, I was struggling to learn to tie my shoes. And at the time, most shoes were laced up shoes. They fit better in a way. You know, they're custom that way. You can make them as tight or as loose as you want. I was playing at a friend's house across the street, a friend who was a child of a doctor. And this doctor had 500 children or something like that. I thought they did. Maybe they had five. I remember the oldest one's name was Gibby. He was not in the Butthole Surfers, but maybe he wanted to be. I don't know. He's closer to Texas Gibby is older than I. But anyway, I was over there playing with these kids who I don't think liked me, if I remember correctly. Do you have any childhood friends like that? You go, I remember playing with this group of children who didn't like me. They kept letting me play there. I've been in situations like that before. It just seems like work, doesn't it? It's like you go to your workplace. You go, I like my office and everything, but I'm pretty sure no one likes me. But this is fine, as long as I have a place to go. That's the way I felt about my friend group. So I was over there one day, and then because they had a large house and a lot of children, they had someone who cleaned for them. And I don't remember what this person even looked like because I was so young. It could have been a big cartoon panda or something. I don't even remember. I think it was a human being. And this person said to me, here, let me show you. And they showed me in such a way that I could tie my shoe. And then I realized I'm not a bad shoe tying student. This is the first good shoe tying teacher I've had. This teacher connected with me, and now I've got it. So I've always approached my shoes that way. I look at them, I say, I'm doing a skill. I've learned something. And it takes a little extra time, too. The more, when I slip on my shoes, I don't go down and visit my feet. You don't have to. You just put them on. You don't go, but if you tie your shoe, you got to go down there and spend some time with your foot. You got to go down there and look at it closely. So how you doing, foot? I'm going to come down and examine my shoe. I'm going to look at my foot while I'm down here. I'm going to look at these laces. This is kind of neat. My grandfather had a shoe shine kit where you put your foot on it. You shine your own shoe, which I think is the way it should be. And it's not easy, but it's something to fuss with. You know, I like to fuss with things. And I like to pay attention to these items so that I value them more. I don't take them for granted. I see how they're put together. I give them some care because they're taking care of me. My shoes. Oh, if I didn't have them, I can't imagine having to walk around without them in some situations. I really do take it for granted. I would really, literally, I could go without pants for the rest of my life, but not shoes. Because I just like to go some places where my feet are touching the ground, not my butt. So if I was dragging my bare behind around, I'd probably say, hey, I want some kind of behind shield. So I like both of those kind of shoes, but they're different. Now, there are some questions on here that are unanswerable, and I like unanswerable questions. Frank asked, what is love? And that question, I would say, I'd like to answer this. What is the question, what is love? That's almost more interesting to me. Love, I've seen lots of examples of, and you know, we've been dissecting that particular emotion for a very, very long time. The Greeks even named different types of love. Now, I think they may have been... I went and I saw a man lecture on Jack... I remember his name. He's a famous paleontologist. And he was saying that a lot of times they'll find remains of a bones and stuff, and they'll name them. They'll say, oh, it's a new species, and they'll name it. But then it turns out maybe it's not a new species. Maybe it is just a transformational stage of the dinosaur's growth, that maybe they look very different as juveniles than they do as adults. And so what you have are the same animal at a different stage in its life. All right? And so when the Greeks have named love and divided it up, maybe it's just one thing. Maybe it's one thing that looks different depending on when you use it, what time of your life. Now, why would we want to know? If love is something that we intuitively understand right out of the womb, and we have little pictures of it, babies and nursing and everything, that's kind of love right there. If we understand that and we know affection and we feel these things, then why are we so obsessed with the definition of it, I wonder? What is this thing that has hold of me? It's very difficult to just experience and let it wash over. What do you call this thing? Just, are you enjoying it? Yes. What is it called? I would tell you, but I guarantee that it will not tell you anything more about that thing. I could tell you its name, but it's just going to, you're just going to have more questions. Then you're just going around using its name in questions. The next question, Lindy. Oh, I miss Lindy. This is on Facebook. I always see people that have, he said, why don't you go see her? I think she lives in another country now. But you see these friends from, you used to be in your community or something, and you move on, you everything, and maybe you never see these folks again. You see them on Facebook or something, and it doesn't mean that they didn't affect your life or that you don't have affection and fond memories for them. You literally can't be with everybody all the time. And so all the people who have ever crossed my path are still with me. It sounds sappy, but they really are. Even the ones that didn't like are still in there, up to no good. Lindy says, do you ever consider covering up your gray? I did until I lost all my hair, and then I thought, well, then now it's moot. But I do have a long gray beard. Well, sometimes it's long, and I did. I told her I did try to dye that once, and it looked absolutely ridiculous. It looked like I was wearing a fake beard. And then I thought, well, what's the point? I'll just let it go. Why? Somebody's not going to know I'm old. I have this nice dark beard, and then you'll look at it and say, what's wrong with your face? Oh, I don't, there's no dye for that. I mean, I guess there I could get all makeup in them. I'm not fooling anybody. I always think about that. You guess people try to look like they're a different age or something from the neck up. I go, well, you're not planning on taking anything off, are you? Because that's a hard thing to... perpetuates. I'm a real clown. Are you? Take off your shirt. Why is there no makeup on your chest? Mike asks, are we there yet? No, we're not, Mike. I'm getting there. Richard asks, what is time? I don't know. David asked something about storytelling. I'm going to get to that. I'm going to come back to that. Because some of these questions, once I start answering, that's it. And the end of the show will just be me going, and I was like that. I won't even get to do the station ID. Molly asks, what's the best snack? What is the best snack? I think it always depends, doesn't it? I always feel like compelled to have healthy snacks, but that might not be what I want. I'd say it has a lot to do with availability. You know, if you can't be with the snack you love, a lot of this has to do with opportunity. The good food is the food that's available. And we maybe forget that a little bit because if it's abundance. But in a world where food isn't guaranteed or it has to be searched for or collected or cultivated, then that's different, I guess, you know. Something very subtle or can be a snack. You know, food that's not obvious can take on more characteristics, can it, when you're hungry or it's scarce or something. Then you say, oh, I'm just going to savor this raw carrot. It's like ambrosia to me. So I don't know. It absolutely depends. And maybe everything does. Let me see. I'm skipping some. I want to come back to them. And then some of them I can't answer ever. David asks, did that girl in first grade have the same level of unspoken affection for me that I had for her? I don't know. When I was in the first grade, I did have a crush on this little girl. And she had a limp. I remember that. And she's very interesting. I think she was very smart. And I remember thinking, if I serenade her, I've seen this, I will go up to her and I will sing her a song, and I don't have anything to strum, nor do I play an instrument. So I shall take this purple plastic thing that's, I guess it's supposed to be a truck. This is one of those toys that's for, you know, the younger the child, they go, not only do we want to not have any removable parts, but let's kind of smooth everything out. So it is kind of a big rounded wad of plastic. But I thought, well, that'll be my banjo. And so what I did is I sang Clementine to her. And she was unimpressed and walked away. I remember, and I thought, what's going on here? I think I've scared her. Here's the thing, I didn't know her. You know, so I think I wasn't, it was a strange thing. I wasn't in love. I don't know what I was. I was interested, or I was, you're scared of people, but you want to be with them. And all that was wonderful feelings that you have for other humans. They conflict, you know. And that was that. And I wanted to make sure that I was too young to understand what the Don Quixote era was, that somebody, that I was entitled to someone's love, or that if I made some kind of effort, that someone, they owed me their affection. And thank goodness I was disabused of that right away, because that's a dangerous thought. And you see that in Don Quixote. What a great book. I was thinking maybe removing all Bibles from church pews and putting Don Quixote in there. And you go, read this. Maybe this you'll actually read, and I think it's going to be helpful, and you'll see yourself in it a lot too. Let's see. Eleanor asks, "How soon is too soon to say I love you in a new relationship?" And when I actually answered her online, I said that I overuse the phrase "I love you" on purpose. So I don't want it to be too precious, you know, too weighty or something. I don't want somebody to hear, you know, I'm the only one for you. Really what I'm saying is, my affection for you feels transcendent. And I feel as much for you as I feel for myself, if I'm going to be honest. You know, that kind of, I want you to live as much as I want myself to live. And you say, well, I feel that way with everybody. Well, take a good look at yourself then, because you're lovable too. You got to love you. Come on. There's one, everything is you're seeing is from your perspective. So it's hard. Oh, it took me a long time. I was waiting for other people to tell me I could love myself. I was waiting for permission. You're not going to get it necessarily. See, I'm not waiting. I can't wait around for other people to tell me I'm worthy or to give me awards or to give me a job that makes me feel good about myself. I'm just running out of time. And there's a lot about me that's just fine. I've been looking at other people and I'm just fine. And, you know, I've had some good times together, me and me. And I think that, you know, I'm gonna be okay. I'm gonna not be my enemy, at least. I'm gonna start there. That's how I started. If you wanna start, do that. Get off your own back, first of all. Outsource it. See, there's so many people who would love the opportunity to be your enemy. You don't have to. You don't have to do it. That is something you do not have to do. It's like getting your house cleaned for free. Say, I don't like this task of being my own. Guess what? They are lining up to volunteer to do it for you. So I don't know. That's what I would do, Eleanor. Go out to a restaurant with this person, and then say to the server, say, I would like the cheese sandwich. I love you, like that. And then they'll say, oh, that's just something that she says. What do you do for work? And what motivates you to find motivation to do these things? I've never really had a steady job doing a thing that I super enjoyed. So I do things for work that pay money, I guess. There's some things I don't want to do, but there's lots of other stuff. I don't mind. Sometimes I can't do intellectual work for other people, and that's just the shortcoming on my part. So I can't to get hired out to think or write. I couldn't be a writer or something like that for somebody, but I can dig holes. I can sell things. You know, say I'd like a pound of cheese. I was like, coming up, sir, and that kind of thing. So I don't mind. I've always. You know, I had this job one time where I was sitting in an office, and I think I was supposed to proofread these documents or something, but there wasn't really enough work, you know, and I just a lot of times just sat there and played SimCity. But then I was thinking, I don't have to be playing SimCity. I could be producing a play. I think I'll get first thing you want to do, if you want to do anything, get a calendar. And what you do is you put all the production dates and meetings on this calendar. Then you call everybody. This is something I learned early. And you call them up and you go, I'm putting on a play. And then you give them the calendar and you go, here's the dates. Who's in? And that way, you know, that's the best way to do it. Here's the date where I didn't have anything together. I literally only had a calendar. And I thought, well, I'll just start a project like that. And I got a whole bunch of people involved. Then if you have a calendar and then you get a lot of people involved, then you get this kind of momentum because then they're in on it too. Right? And then you just start delegating. And ultimately, you shouldn't have to do anything except put the calendar together and call the meeting. That's the way I work. So my motivation for doing things is to create opportunities inside or outside of my labors to be with people and work with people. I like to blur the line between socializing and work. So that's really easy and music and a lot of things because it just feels like we're getting together and having fun a lot of times. My friends, when we're actually making things, sometimes people pay us to do it, other times not. But I like those opportunities. Even moving furniture. So the last time I had the best fellowship I had recently was about, well, it was last year. I've had more recent than that probably. But last year I was helping a friend of a friend move some furniture, some boxes, you know? And it was great. And for me, it was the schmoozing. It was the camaraderie, the fun, you know. And I don't mind lifting things. I like physical work, you know. So if I can just do physical work and chat, that's great. I mean, that's just like the last scene of Office Space. Well, the last scene of Office Space is the guy on the beach. Scene before that. Then what motivates you? I think I covered that. And skipping. Here's an interesting one. What are the biggest changes in your life since starting the show? Asks William. I'm going to answer that in two different ways, because he sort of asked what has happened during the last 10 years or so that has changed you. But I will also answer how has the show itself changed my life, because it has. So I've been doing what I'm doing, which is speaking like this, for quite a while before I came on this radio station. And I've been trying to make art or be myself or do this stuff for a while. And then I got the opportunity to be on this radio station. And then I met a whole new group of people. A lot of open-minded people, too. Because what I do isn't exactly obvious or... See, I just said, that's not that... That doesn't occur in a lot of entertainment that you're engaged in. And a lot of the podcasts and things you listen to have actual information. What I do is a little more loosey-goosey, right? It's a stranger often. And, you know, I understand that not a lot of call for it. So I did find a place where it felt normal, as if this is something people do all the time. Another thing that happened is because I was on the radio, I think it lent credence to what I was doing. So I worked at a magazine for a while, a poetry magazine in school, and people would submit their poetry. And I'm going to confess something to you, and I suspected this with other people. I realized I did not know what was good and what was bad. I just knew what I liked. And that sounds lame. I tried to be sophisticated. I mean, I had studied things, right? I should know. But some things, if people broke rules, it excited me. You know, so it was very, very hard. I was supposed to be looking for something that sounded like all the other stuff, you know? But that drove me crazy. So I was kind of looking for stuff that didn't sound like the other stuff. Now, that's uncharted territory. And so we were all scared. And everybody was scared to publish anything. So what we do is you look at the biography of the person who submitted it. And you'd see, let's look at their credentials. How many publications do they have? They teach somewhere. Are they famous? They published. And then we go, okay, well then maybe this is inventive and not crappy. And you don't want to believe that that's going on. But it really is. It's the emperor's new clothes sort of thing a lot of times. And then I realized that, you know, people want to be told sometimes whether something's good or not. They're afraid to commit. They're afraid to like it. I mean, there's nothing worse than liking something and then showing it to somebody and somebody poos all over it. And they go, oh, I just love this singer, this record. And they go, let me see that. Here, smear my feces. And you go, okay, well, that hurts. You know, and they go, the reason that you're probably asking why I put excrement on your record. Yes, I was wondering. It's because your taste's unsophisticated. What you don't realize is what you're listening to is derivative and stale. You go, oh, okay. I was getting joy out of it. I understand that, and I don't begrudge you that joy for sure. But I want you to open your eyes a little and know that there's other stuff that I think that demands your attention. I still think that way, I think, a little bit. I don't trust my judge, and I shouldn't. I'm not an expert. I can't tell if a scientific paper is good or bad, and I can't tell if a lot of art is good or bad, and experts can, by and large, and I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying it's a conundrum, because it's difficult to know what you like. And so it's a conundrum for the artist, too, because I'm thinking, who has to like me for it to be good? Who has to enjoy my work? I want what I do to be, whatchacallitized. I've totally forgot this word. I'm so sorry, but I want it to be recognized as being important or inventive or something like that, right? And some kind of affirmation, you know. I don't know what I want. But what happens is you know, you can get that externally for good or for bad. I was walking into a show in college one time as a band, and the person in front asked the person taking tickets, is this a local band? And they said, yes. And the person walked away and they said, I don't like local music. I go, wow, I didn't even know that was a genre. I thought that just meant like musicians from our town. But what that person was saying is like, this band has not been vetted. I may walk in there and what if they're amateurish? You know? And a lot of people take the chance that, you know, maybe it's good. Maybe they'll go somewhere. Maybe they're great. Maybe they great and won't go anywhere. Maybe they're bad and will. Who knows? But the experience that you have in there, that's up to you, kind of. So I would say that since I've started the show, I've become more, I'm thankful for every single person that I interact with, because I'm anticipating the end, where I say things like, I used to have a radio show, and people go, oh, okay, and they walk away. Say, so I used to be on television. Oh, really? Not anymore. And they walk away. So you said, got to have something else there, right? So the things that have changed, that in conjunction of losing people, that always wakes me up and always changes me. And now that I've been on the radio for a very long time, I started in 1989. Now I have met people through the radio show who I've lost. So you make a friend as a listener, becomes a friend, and they die. And that, while you're on, it's very, very strange, you know? And then molding me more. And I think that keeps me sane in a way. I don't want them to die, but it's perspective, right? It's the relationship I value. It's the connection I care about. And all that I'm doing when I speak like this is I'm crying out for connection. I'm looking for other people to say, I understand. Yes, yes, I'm a human being. I understand what you're saying. So it isn't that I don't want an award for this. Oh, he said something I related to in such a beautiful, inventive way. Here's your award. That doesn't mean anything to me. If you reach out your hand, you say you touched me or something, that's going to last me after I'm off the radio, after I have no obvious credentials, or I have no imprimatur. I know I skipped some questions, now I have to go back. I will also be, of course, making some up because... Do you ever perform with a band? Yes, music. I've never done spoken word with a band, have I? I don't think so. In the past, I've done some aggressive art. What's aggressive art? So, I mean, I don't want to hurt people, and I don't want to make people uncomfortable who don't need to be made uncomfortable. But I was been in some positions where, you can be outrageous in such a subtle way, and it still annoy people out, absolutely out of proportion to what you're doing. So if you show up in a space that's supposed to be a certain kind of music or a certain kind of theater, and you do something very different than that, and it doesn't have to be shocking at all. It just has to be unexpected or disorienting. And now I've done that with the band without playing music. But mostly I like to play music and I want people to dance and be happy. But sometimes I do want to, spew nonsense while somebody else plays stand-up bass or theremin. That happened one time. So I like that. I like that. There's different situations call for different artistic responses by the artist. I was thinking like a repairman. You show up. Maybe the artist shouldn't have any idea what they're going to do. Say, so tell me how many people in the theater. Well, it's 200. All right. There's stage? Yes. Well, what will you be doing?
I don't know.
I'm going to wait. Let's see. I don't know. I haven't seen anybody yet. I feel that way with this show. People ask me if I write it. I do. I write after a fashion. I don't always write things down. But this is what I do for most shows. Ones that don't have a lot of, the ones that seem like Scooby-Doo episodes, I got to write that stuff down because that's complicated, right? I don't know when to put things in. I can't improvise everything. And I don't think I'm improvising right now. I think that I'm working off what I call secret script. So what I do is during the week, I try to notice things. I try to be as alert and contemplative and inquisitive as I possibly can. So if I'm walking in my garden, I try to look for things I haven't seen before. If I'm out in public, I try to look around for something. Maybe I'll see that and I'll go, boy, I got to go look that up. So I'll do a little reading about it. And then I'll look at something else completely different. And go and read about that and look about that. Like one time I was walking down a path and I saw some Osage oranges. They're bizarre fruit. Doesn't look like an orange. Looks like a weapon or something. Looks like the end of a mace. Like you'd put it on a chain and swing it. And it's a bumpy, large softball looking thing. Osage orange. And I want to think they call them monkey trees too. They might call them monkey trees. Monkey balls or something. There's fun names for it. And so I was thinking about those kind of things all week that week. Osage oranges and then monkeys and monkeys in trees and all that sort of thing. And then at the end of the week, they've all been stuck into my mind palace. I take souvenirs in the form of images based on these thoughts and ideas, and I set them on the little table in a room that I'm imagining in my head. And then at the end of the week, I come back and I look at all the things that I put in these rooms, and I try to find a pattern, even if they're unrelated. What was I thinking? Why was I thinking about, monkeys and oranges? And then I was thinking about Chinese mythology, because that monkey's stealing peaches, and it all came together. It starts to make itself into something. And it turns out that unconsciously, the me in my head that doesn't check in daily with my conscious self is in there thinking about stuff. And so what I do is I go around and I try to figure out what my unconscious self has been thinking all week by looking at the things that my conscious self decided to pick up and notice. What's the connection with all the things I noticed this week? And I'm going to tell my friends about it. Because maybe they'll get a third thing out of it. They'll see something that I didn't even know that I put there. And that's why I look at this as a collaboration. That's why it works at all, I think. It's because you're in on it. You add a thing to it. I just give you the mix. Say, well, I made a cake, and they go, did you make it? You go, well, I used a mix. That's no problem. You still put stuff in it. You still put it together. You added a thing. I added a thing. It's a collaboration, and that's why I think the show is a collaboration. It's not straight up entertainment, or everybody would recognize it as that. Oh, no. No, no. Some people might say, listen to Hardy White's show, and they say, I don't know, this is too much effort, or I didn't get anything out of it, or I couldn't follow it, or, you know, because it's not, I wasn't speaking to that person, they didn't need it or something. That's fine. I understand that. And that applies to people I know personally. And that's another thing you forget. my friend John always says, don't make your friends your fans. And that's because they may not actually like your art, but they may love you. So I'm absolutely fine with that. It frees me up with other people, you know. If you're playing a type of music that doesn't speak to me necessarily, I can still love you with all my heart. And, you know, that we don't share the same passions is fine with me if it's okay with you. And so I've come to accept that a lot of people that know me or personal friends have almost never listened to my show. But why would they? Like if they could go out to coffee with me. Are you different in real life than you are on the radio, Hardy? No one asked me that. No, I'd say I'm not really. I don't think I am. Maybe I am. You're doing a character. When? When? On the show? Or in real life? Because I agree with you, I'm doing a character in real life. Oh, for sure. Oh, for sure. Stakes are higher. What if somebody doesn't like the real me? Oh, no, no. I'd rather them not like the character. No, I hide behind a character in real life. And then this person that you're hearing right now, that's just me. That's just me. You say, I don't believe that. Challenge. I will challenge you right now. I have been just on this radio station 9 years. I've only missed a couple weeks. Okay? Ran a couple repeats due to illness. But that's, if I could do mathematics or maths, I would say that the formula I would lay out would be 52 times 9. Okay, and that's how many hours I've spoken on the radio. Now, you try to phony it up. You try to hide yourself speaking that many hours. Go on. 400 and some hours. There's more than that. I don't know, man. I told you. But I don't know. But try to hide who you really are speaking that often and that amount. You can't. But I can certainly hide who I am. To individuals, I don't think I've spoken that many hours to any one person.
You have to me, Hardy.
See? Oh, that makes me feel good. I'm glad. Feels good to be wanted, you know? And I'm going to spin it, though. If they say it's time to leave the radio station, I'm gonna say that's not being unwanted. It's just, I'm going to say that's being not needed right now. And I understand that. If I was a chimney sweep and I walked down and said, "Now, you know, you need your chimney swept?" And they go, "No, I don't. It's all clean." I would say, "You are personally rejecting me." No, they're not. They're personally rejecting the thing that you do. They just don't need it. And so, it's other people who do. Say good day. You tip your hat and you go to them. And when I leave this show, I will tip my hat and I will go to them. I wonder where they are. I'll have to find them first. I have friends and they get together, I think. I'll just find where they're at. Birthday parties or something. I'll be there. I'll go, you sure you don't want me to just say a few words? They'll go, no, we're cool. Could you imagine you say, oh, come say a few words at my wedding. If I do the ceremony, I'm much shorter, though. But if you ask me to do a toast, forget it. I think I'd get me to tape it so you can edit it. Now, I went past some of the questions, but I wanted to come back to them. Remember, I said one of them was complicated, so I wanted to. Well, David asked about storytelling. I mean, I've talked about story a lot, and I don't know that the things that I tell are necessarily stories. And I've always mentioned that. Where when I grew up, the word story was synonymous with lie. So my grandmother would say, you're telling stories. Oh, you're telling a story. I go, yeah, I am. So I grew up thinking that something in a story form was itself a lie because it was leaving things out. I was choosing to say certain things and ignore others. So all stories have a lot of things omitted, consciously omitted. Now, how can you recount an event without putting it in story form? You can absolutely do that. I could tell you an event. All right, let's say I was telling you about a traffic accident. Now, we know this from movies and everything. We do this all the time. But in stories, we always want to start at what we call the beginning. But see, that's not the first thing to pop into our head necessarily. We may not want to start at the beginning. The beginning may not have anything to do with this. And what is the beginning? So the best way to tell a story is to just start recounting emotions and details in no particular order and not ascribing them to it, not trying to find connections. Connections are inherent in everything. And when you try to make them up, when they're not there, they're going to be forced. There is great poetry in just taking two disparate objects and putting them together. You don't even need to explain how they're alike. Their presence next to one another, that couch and that avocado, they're going to speak volumes because their differences are poetry. Their differences are the truth. And we can't put that in story form quite. We have to just have these things juxtaposed and walk around them and talk about them and talk around them. When we try to tell their story or make sense of their origin, we're going to leave all the good stuff out. So just talk. You're going to say something, Hardy. And I know this from experience, that if I want to get 3 minutes of truth, then I'm probably going to have to speak for an hour. And I apologize for that. But should I distill it ahead of time? I just don't think it would be the same thing. There's no way that I wouldn't become self-conscious of that thing I was presenting. I would write it and I would rewrite it. And I do that when I write. I want to make sure the words have a certain rhythm and that kind of thing. When I speak to you, it's entirely different. You are hearing things as they dawn on me. But they didn't just dawn on me. They've been bouncing around there for a long time. And the way I speak and the patterns I use, all that stuff was already there.
You guys go do something. I'm just going to read some of these questions silently no, that's not true. But I knew I was skipping over a really good one. I asked the one about this. I think it was favorite fast food option, favorite slow food option. I got to tell you, I think the best thing that fast food does are French fries. I've had some French fry experiences that have absolutely been exquisite, ecstatic experiences with that hot French fry. Perfect combination of grease and salt and sweet and starch and everything. It was just so satisfying. And so that thing, that's my favorite. And it's almost, I remember just getting some fries somewhere in France. I think maybe sometimes I drink a lot when I'm on. Places I'm not from, strange places. You go, uh-oh. I better have some sake. I had fries one night and it was cold and there was just a place just selling fries and it was beautiful. I'm not sure that would have happened. You know how that is with experiences. You can't reproduce them necessarily. I go through a drive-thru right now. I get some fries. They'd be disgusting maybe. So it's all about context. And as far as slow food, any kind of preparation that we do with people takes a long time or forever. I sure do love that. We're just all sitting around talking, cooking, making food. Ugh, that's the best. So it's the people. Because I never enjoy eating alone. Well, I do it, but it's never quite the same. Todd says, "Dear Hardy, whither and whence?" Dear Hardy, whither and whence is a question. I don't know why I didn't do the question inflection. First of all, I love Todd. Todd has actually given me more things, that ideas for the show. I'm not sure on purpose, but he's inspired, sometimes with objects, because he's given me wonderful books that have inspired me for weeks. Then, and sometimes it's just a cartoon thing or something strange, you know. But he has a knack for that. He has a knack for the interesting and the ephemeral. So I preach that. So when he says that, you know, where have we been, where are we going, is what he's asking. And I think that's a great question. I don't know where we've been exactly. It's starting to fade. I'm not sure we've even been there. And I certainly don't know what's ahead. People say, oh, you have a time machine. Can't you anticipate being sick or something? I don't know. Because here's the thing with a time machine. I jump all around. I don't just go live an entire lifetime in the future. I still have a finite lifetime. So when I pop into the future, I pop there for a day. Hard to say what went on before and after that day. I just don't know. I don't know the day I'm in quite went on yesterday and what will be going on tomorrow. So I always am in the middle of things. Always in the middle of things. And I will die in the middle of things. I've thought about that a lot when I'm watching movies that have sequels. I think, oh, this is, what a cruel thing. Because you think some Harry Potter fan, some Star Wars fan, some Avengers fan died right in the middle of the movie series. You know? Never got to the end. And that's the way everything is. You just come in the middle of it. What was going on here? Oh, yep, people have been around for thousands, thousands, thousands of years. What about this, the culture and everything? Thousands, thousands of years, all this stuff, and the language? Oh, yeah, same thing. All right, so maybe I should, bye. And then you're gone. And then new people come in, they go, what was going on here? And they go, oh, lots of stuff. So if you do have a problem with confusion, and I understand that our brains are trying to make sense of things all the time, set a low bar for that sense. Understand that things have causes, but they'll be forever, a lot of them will be forever hidden from you. And that's a thing that's sort of difficult to understand, is that, you know, logically I realize nothing is random, but then practically lots of things are random because I cannot see their causes. Their causes are obscure. And so I don't know quite what's going on. I mean, my predictive abilities, if something has been consistent for a while, you can predict it, right? The ancients were like that. Well, the weather's gone, and we know it's going to be, the weather's going to be consistent. And then if they have some event that's unusual, like a volcano or something, it can be jarring to their worldview. Like, what? Now, Pompeii, they didn't know to run. That was the problem. Oh, my friends, I know that you have questions. I have questions too. Like, why didn't I leave enough time for the intro? And I apologize for that. But I have enough time for the station ID. And you are listening to Miracle Nutrition, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, 91.9 in Rockland County in New York City, New York, and online worldwide, WFMU.org. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for asking questions. Thank you for having questions. And thank you for not expecting answers. I was standing.
We want to welcome you to the Center's Crossroads Gospel Broadcast. If you are tired and weary,